Hey there, my DPC Story listeners. Marielle here. I'm thrilled to invite you to a game-changing event I'm hosting featuring Dr. Lauren Heddy. For the past decade, Dr. Lauren Heddy has been pioneering in direct primary care with her practice, Direct Doctors. She's kept her overhead to a mere 20% with zero staff, and now she's ready to share more of her strategies with you. That's right, folks. Dr. Heddy's practice has been booming, with four physicians joining her at her two locations. If you've ever wondered how to keep overhead low, streamline workflows without staff, and experience exponential growth, then this event is an absolute must. And here's the best part. Tickets are pay what you can. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to learn from one of the best in the biz. Reserve your spot now for our virtual Ask the Expert with Dr. Heddy, which will happen on April 30th. Get tickets on the events tab at mydpcstory.com and get ready to elevate your practice to new heights.
Direct primary care to me just means bringing primary care back to where it was 50 years ago. I am Dr. Katrini Iqbal.
And I am Nir Patel of Direct Med.
And this is our DPC story.
Dr. Iqbal received her undergraduate degree in nutrition from the University of Texas at Austin and attended Midwestern University in Glendale, Arizona for medical school. Following medical school, she trained at the UT Southwestern Family Medicine Residency, also in Austin. Prior to founding Direct Med, Dr. Iqbal spent several years working in various urgent care centers. Nir Patel is an engineer by degree, but an entrepreneur at heart. Nir and his wife, Dr. Katrini Iqbal, opened their direct primary care practice in 2015. Nir also owns Virtuous Benefits, a boutique benefits firm that helps employer groups break free from their broken health insurance system by teaching them a long-term strategy on how to take control of their ever-rising healthcare costs. This proven strategy is being implemented by linking employers with hundreds of DPC physician practices across the country. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Iqbal and Nir.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to ask you about the creation of Direct Med and how you both ended up working together. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that all happened?
Yep, sure. So after residency, I worked in urgent care for about 3.5 years. It was just kind of a pretty easy transition for me because I had moonlighted as a third year resident. And after residency, I just wanted a paycheck. I just wanted something like pretty simple. And so urgent care just made sense for me. And then I quickly got burnt out of urgent care and I was wanting to get back into primary care. And I just realized from talking to my colleagues in town that jumping ship from urgent care to a large primary care institution in Austin wasn't going to be the best situation for us because of like the really strict non-competes primarily. And I just didn't want to be run into the ground in a primary care setting. So one of my colleagues that I had met, Dr. Chris Larson here in Austin, we did urgent care together for a while. He was starting up his direct primary care before us. And we basically just learned everything from him and picked his brain about it on how to get started. And my husband, Nir, is much more business-minded and entrepreneurial than I am. So I definitely would have never started my DPC without him. So he really kind of helped me with the business aspect of it and all the admin stuff. So finding an office space and just all that stuff, because I would have never known how to do any of that and navigate through it. And then it just kind of evolved into him just handling all the administrative non-medical stuff. And I obviously would see the patients.
And Nir, how about your take on things?
I always knew that Katrini was entrepreneurial and that she wanted to do something for herself. And it was just about trying to figure out, you know, what that would be. So really thankful to have met Dr. Larson and, you know, have him kind of help us kind of get guided on DPC and educated on it. And then we just kind of took the reins from there and started doing our own research. And we quickly realized that was the direction we wanted to go. And we started our practice about 6 years ago from scratch.
And when you guys started out, after having spoken and being able to pick the brain of Dr. Larson, what was your guys' experience with regards to finding your first space?
So I had thought that we were going to get just traditional family practice office space. And then we talked to some of our other colleagues that had their own private practices in town. And their advice to us was to keep your overhead low as low as possible, especially in an insurance-based and especially like in a direct primary care type setting. So we just thought outside of the box. Our first office was super tiny. It was what, 300 square feet. It was very small, had one exam room. It was real quaint and it met our needs. And then we eventually were growing. So we just had to have different space, which has led us now to our new space that we moved in about this time last year.
I think Katrina forgot to mention how I had to talk her out of trying to get us locked into a 5-year, very expensive lease with a big office space with 3 or 4 exam rooms and a waiting room and all the traditional aspects of kind of what a family practice would look like on the insurance side. I kind of told her I thought that was not the wisest way to start and that we should keep our overhead low. So she finally heard what I had to say about that. Yeah. And we found a nice little space that we renovated ourselves and launched in.
It's interesting though, because, you know, for those of us who have done fee-for-service care of any sort, it's very real how in our minds, a clinic means a certain thing, right? Like a physical space with a door, a waiting room, a person to check you in, an exam room, possibly a procedure room, a bathroom, a break room. And it is very interesting to hear, you know, how you guys found your space and how, you know, you had that idea of keeping your overhead low as you shifted from being a fee-for-service doctor to working as a team of entrepreneurs. So I think that's wonderful that you guys did what worked for you. And then what about your space now? What were some of the things that you thought about as you moved into a larger space?
So the space that we have now is still shared space. We actually rent 3 exam rooms from a local allergist here in town. The allergist is Dr. Amiri, and he built his building a couple years ago and had extra rooms. He basically has 2 hallways. One of the hallways is just for him and his needs. And then the other hallway he was using for like aesthetics once upon a time, which didn't work out for him. And then thankfully we stumbled upon him and found out that he had this extra space. And it was actually really perfect because I really still operate out of 1 exam room because I just turn the room around myself. But now that we have a second physician and hopefully one day we'll have a third physician, we just wanted to have enough space for us all to be officed in the same building. And the nice thing about subleasing from an established medical practice is we can share a lot of common areas. So like the waiting room and reception, we basically get because we're renters there. And then like they have a back like break room and obviously the bathroom. So like we kind of benefit from what they have already established. So it's a perfect situation. Like I never want to move again. I really, really enjoy the space. It's beautiful. It's convenient location. All of our patients have really enjoyed our new space. And even our patients that started with us in the beginning, I was so nervous about having an office that was non-traditional and outside of the traditional, exam room. And my patients were all just happy to see me. And then that was just the important thing that just rang home was the patients didn't come to see what kind of fancy office you have. They really just want to have really good care and they just want to have that relationship. And so that was what was very impressionable on me. And obviously we want to be surrounded by nice things, but the patients just want to see you. So that was really important to us.
I think, it's important to understand that, you know, you definitely want to think outside the box when you're starting a DPC and kind of looking for space and doing all the startup things that you need to do, because we, in our new office, we have 3 exam rooms and that's it. So that's going to be 1 exam room per physician. There's no lab. There's no place for a receptionist. I do what we need to do for the admin side of the practice from home. And, we don't need to pay for additional space that we don't need. And so it's just a way to keep our overhead low and keep things as efficient as we can.
And Katrina, with you guys having 3 exam rooms and potentially 3 exam rooms, 1 for each physician as you grow, do you set up a small area in your exam room for like a desk, or how do you use your space?
Yeah, so I would say they're larger size exam rooms, and I have a real compact desk that I have my laptop on, and then I have two like captain chairs for my patient, and then plus one, whoever they're bringing, if they are bringing someone to sit with. And we spend the majority of our visit sitting in that kind of a triangle with me sitting right next to them, well, close to them in our the exam room. And then I have an exam table, like a traditional family medicine exam table that can turn into do pelvic exams. And then I have like a wall of cabinets, and then I have a counter space with a sink. And so that kind of converts over into my little mini lab, so I can do rapid tests. So I offer like rapid strep, rapid flu, UA, pregnancy tests, glucose testing. I have a EKG, which is super, I have as a small footprint. So it's a one that just plugs into the leads, plug into my computer. And so it's a software that we use. And then, so I can use my, procedure tray to, put my laptop on for whenever I want to do an EKG. So it's the small, the footprint's very small for everything. It's very intentional on how, what we purchased for the office so that, it could be stored efficiently.
And how do you guys handle autoclaving? Do you have that set up in one of the common areas?
No, I mean, I have, disposable, supplies and tools, so I don't autoclave anything. So like all my speculums or plastics, I dispose of them. And then if I'm using like a clamp or something for removing an IUD, I just dispose of it. So they're all disposable, because the procedures that we do, and like, so I have a LAC setup and IND setup, like all of those sort of tools, I just purchase disposable ones.
If you guys have any need for supplies or you have extras, do you and Dr. Larson and any other physicians trade supplies?
Yeah, absolutely. The nice thing about direct primary care, especially here in Austin, is the culture. We're all helpful with each other, and it's not competitive between any of the DPCs here in town. And so we all share best practices. We ask, you know, each other commonly. Like we just had a conversation with Dr. Mike Garrett, who was my cross coverage before, about like, what did he do with this situation? And so we all kind of lean on each other, and even down to supplies. Like I ran out of lidocaine, and there was like a national shortage of lidocaine, and I needed to do a joint injection on a patient. And, this was like a year or two. And then, Mike Garrett, who is my cross coverage at the time, he had extra lidocaine, and I offered to purchase it from him, and he just gave it to me for free. And then, like a few months after that, he was short flu swabs, and he needed a person coming in, specifically wanted a flu test at that time. And he couldn't get his hands on any more flu swabs or flu tests from his vendor. And so I just dropped some off when I was helped by his office. So like, we're all just friendly and try to help each other out, because we all understand we started, you know, from scratch, and we're all just trying to be helpful to each other.
It's wonderful. And definitely, you know, a testament to the spirit of DPC. Mm-hmm. In terms of your guys's patient panel, what does your patient panel look like now? And as you guys discussed, you're looking to potentially add a third physician. What's your ideal patient panel per physician?
So in the beginning, I think that I had a much smaller panel idea, like in my head. Like I was thinking I'd only have like 400 patients or so, but I think that I'll be able to handle closer to like 500-600 patients on my panel. And I think that would be kind of the expectation for our physicians that we have join us. With regards to like the demographic, I feel like it was very niche in the beginning, because not a lot of people knew what DPC was out in this area. And so I predominantly had like a female population in the beginning. And I'm just presuming because I'm a female myself, but that's really grown. And I haven't done a recent percentage of like the demographic and how it breaks down recently, but it's a lot wider demographic, and it's not just people that are privileged or wealthy. I swear I have everyone from the spectrum. I have people that are busboys at restaurants to CEOs, like C-suite people. And so it's a really nice wide range in our patient demographic, which is nice. And because and just gives you the whole scope of what's out in the population. I don't have like a huge pediatric population. It's usually the adults that come in and they want me to see their kids. I only see like 12 months and up just because that's my comfort from being out of residency. I was doing urgent care and we didn't see 12 months and under. And so I just kind of got away from newborn care. And so that was just my own comfort level, was not to see newborns.
With you guys having your own DPC community within Austin, if there was a newborn where the family was under your care, or if there was a female patient at Dr. Garrett's or Dr. Larson's, do you guys ever refer patients for, you know, one time or well child check visits to each other to help each other out?
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Your calls for more content have not fallen on deaf ears. I am so excited to announce the My DPC Story Patreon community. Delve into exclusive full-length interviews with pioneers like Dr. Neeti Kapoor, our inaugural physician guest, and get further enlightening insights from our current season's doctors, starting with Dr. Harpreet Sui. Hear our guests share even more, from their worst days to their best days and everything in between. Get access to this treasure trove of conversations and more by joining our My DPC Story community now. Check out the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/mydpcstoryfan. That's patreon.com/mydpcstoryfan.
We've helped each other out with regards to other things, but not for like well checks. We have had several families have welcomed new babies to their family, and they want us to see them. And we just, I don't have really the equipment, or I don't have an assistant to help me with like a newborn. And again, my comfort level with newborns isn't great. So we actually just have them follow with a pediatrician during their first year of life, versus just having one of our colleagues. And I actually don't think that a lot of our other DPC colleagues see newborns. I'd have to double check that, but I don't think that they do. With regards to like females and then my male counterparts seeing those females, I haven't had any of them ask me to see for a well woman exam. I would be happy to do that, but I think they have those kind of situations in place. I don't know if they actually just still do female exams and just have a chaperone or have them see a gynecologist. But I would be happy to do that if they ask that of me. Before I had my own in-office hearing screen for kids, I had a parent need their kid to get a hearing screen. I didn't have the tool yet in my office. And so Mike Garrett had seen the kid in his office for no charge and did the hearing screen for me, just so that he could get into school. So we definitely help each other out where we can. There's one of our female DPCs, April Calderon, who is Dr. Chris Larson's wife. She joined him in his practice recently, and she has extra training in women's health. And so she actually does colposcopies and biopsies in her office. And so that's been a really cost-effective way of getting our patients colposcopies if needed, versus having them go to a gynecologist's office where it's going to be a lot more expensive. So that's been a really helpful resource for us with like sharing, because all of us DPCs have our own little areas of where we've had interest and whatnot.
I definitely have seen in communities where there are multiple DPCs a collaboration. And I think that spirit is really wonderful to continue to add value to your patients in a different way. What EMR and communication platforms do you use and why?
So when we first opened shop in 2015, we used Practice Fusion, mainly because it was free and we were trying to keep our costs low, our overhead costs. It was really, you know, basic. You could electronically prescribe. You could integrate with a local lab. It served its purpose. And then we had heard about Atlas MD from our DPC colleagues and were growing more interest in it and what it could be used for with regards to integrating billing and making it more streamlined. And so we switched over to Atlas MD about 2 years ago, I think, near, right? And I'm not very IT savvy, so I try to resist any sort of change with learning new technology. but once I jumped ship, it's been, I really do enjoy AtlasMD. Like I can still electronically prescribe. We integrate the our local lab into the system. So it just gets fed in, all the lab results get fed right into the charts. It's been really easy and streamlined from like the billing perspective. And I'm sure Nir can talk about that. And then it's so simple, and it was designed for direct primary care physicians and their practices. And it just makes sense. And it's very, I've really enjoyed using AtlasMD. And then, so you can, message back and forth through AtlasMD through like text and email, and it goes right into the chart. For electronic communications, I use Spruce, which is a HIPAA compliant app that the patient can download once they're invited to it. And I just think it's really easy for me to use it. I can have it on my computer. I can have it up on my phone. It's pretty streamlined to send messages, attachments, pictures. And then I can, if I needed to create a telephone encounter or electronic message, I can just cut and paste that and put it into their chart.
And Katrini, when you were mentioning the communication functions of Atlas and then adding Spruce, what were you finding that Spruce helped you out with that Atlas wasn't providing?
My hesitation with using only Atlas for the communications was that every communication would be saved into their chart. And I just didn't want the notes to look real messy and like a lot of extra clutter to have to scroll through. And so that was kind of like my main purpose of not using the Atlas functions for communications, is I just want to have a simple note, and I don't want to have to be filtering through if I'm trying to find like, what did we talk about, you know? And so whenever like I'm messaging on Spruce with a patient going back and forth with their whatever issue, like an acute issue, I can just summarize it really easily and put that right into the notes, like into the AtlasMD notes section. And that way it's just much more concise versus going reading through all of like the back and forth.
Definitely. And in terms of Spruce, which version are you using?
We're using the lower version, just the one that allows team communications and then patient communications.
On the internal side of Spruce, how do you guys set up your Spruce communication?
So each physician is different, right, with regards to how they operate and how tech savvy they are and what they like. So Katrini is using Spruce in addition to Atlas, and Spruce mainly just for the secure communications between her patients. Dr. Keller is using Atlas for everything. So her communications are going through text message and email through Atlas. I am the common denominator between the two of them. So I usually work in Spruce when I'm working with Katrini's patients and she's tagging me for things that she needs help with. And then same thing for Dr. Keller. She's at mentioning me in Atlas when she needs help with something, and I'm working with her patients and her in Atlas.
Katrini, prior to Dr. Keller joining in on the practice, how did you handle any safety concerns, specifically like a male patient by yourself?
In my first office, I was kind of a lone duck and I was all by myself. And so that definitely like crossed my mind. I'm like, I really didn't have like tons of protection with regards to like safety. I would have like a chaperone. So technically my mom is a retired ER nurse, and she was helping me out in the beginning when I was in my first office space. And so anytime I had like a sensitive exam, she would be up at the office with me and be my chaperone. In our second office, we were actually officing out of a wellness compounding pharmacy that had a couple of exam rooms where a previous physician was officing. I've actually asked their staff to be on watch for, there was this one patient that was drug seeking and getting out of the hospital and trying to get pain pills. And so they were kind of like my security, and I use them as like chaperones when needed. And then in our current space that we're in, again, the allergist office is basically fully staffed, and they always have someone up front. And so they're kind of our backup chaperone and security per se.
When a patient does establish with you guys have meet and greets. What does that look like for your practice?
So not every patient that comes in requests a meet and greet, but I don't know, what would you say, like 30% of people interested in the practice are either want to do like a virtual meet and greet, or we used to do a lot more in-office meet and greets when I was first starting up, and then obviously pre-COVID. But the meet and greet is a 30-minute for them to get to know me, like personally and then professionally. It is a non-medical decision visit. So I will not make any sort of like recommendations whatsoever. I've had a few people misunderstand the concept and like bring their like previous labs for me to interpret. And I just set them aside. I'm like, this is just for you to get to know about the practice itself, how it works, my approach to treating patients. But I don't, there's no medical decision making during those visits. And for a lot of people, I feel like they are really just coming to meet me to make sure I'm not like crazy. And then also just to have a better understanding on some of like the ins and outs and how the actual model works. And I felt like the majority of the people that do the meet and greets will sign up as a patient. So I felt like it's really helpful. It's, again, it's a free thing that we do just because we do have like a 1-year agreement for our membership. So sometimes that can be a little daunting for people to sign up for if they've never met you.
When you mentioned the 1-year agreement and that 30-ish percent of patients request the meet and greet, a couple things come to mind. One, how did you guys come to decide on having that 1-year agreement? And have you noticed the number of people requesting the meet and greet has gone down as you guys have published content like the video where you share your experience prior to opening your DPC?
I think it's probably come down some with some of the content we've been posting to help people understand how our practice works. You know, reviews on Yelp, Google, and Facebook have been super helpful for people to, you know, go and kind of look and see what other patients have to say about how we operate and how we take care of our patients. You know, I would say on average, we're probably doing a couple meet and greets a week. It's been really helpful for us to get patients to be comfortable to sign up for our membership. We decided to set up our membership as a 12-month agreement, you know, simply just to deter patients from trying to use us for one or two issues and then leave. We're trying to, you know, create our practice to be family medicine like it was 50 years ago. We want all of our patients to feel like they have a meaningful relationship with each of their physicians. And so, you know, continuity of care is really important in that picture. So, you know, I think having a 12-month agreement just sort of helps kind of align with that philosophy of, you know, us wanting to take care of families for generations and provide really good continuity of care.
With you guys having a 1-year agreement, have you noticed any specific churn trends over the years that you've been in practice because of that agreement?
I don't think we've had a huge turnover. I don't know the exact percentage that is like every year. I think the majority of the reasons why people will cancel their membership with us is because they're usually moving somewhere, and whether that's out of state or just out of town. And they just want to have their doctor closer to them. So, but that's like the majority of the reason why people will cancel their membership.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the turnover percentage is so low that I don't track it. And, you know, we are by no means, you know, trying to hold anybody at our practice that doesn't want to be here. So, you know, if somebody needs to cancel earlier than 12 months, we just tally up the amount of care we've provided, subtract out the membership dues they've paid in, and either there would be a balance or there wouldn't. That's kind of how we make it fair for both sides.
And we tally it up based off of, because I used to do fee-for-service in addition to offering a membership model. And so we had published fee-for-service rates. And so if someone, say they were a member for 2 months, but I saw them like 5 times or something and were really using it, but then canceled. One, like again, no hard feelings if they want to cancel for whatever reason. But there are, I feel like we got burned early on in the beginning with some people just trying to use this as an urgent care and had no intention with staying for continuity of care. And so we had those initial fee-for-service rates published. And so we just have that understanding that if you cancel within prior to that 12 months, then the services provided. So like whether it was a comprehensive annual physical or just a routine follow-up, we had those prices and then we just convert over to those.
If a person were to leave and then realize the value of your practice, do you have a sign-up fee that they have to then pay if they rejoin?
Yeah, so we don't charge an enrollment fee when new patients join our practice, but if they leave and they want to come back, there is a re-enrollment fee.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. you to Spruce Health for supporting the My DPC Story podcast. The ways we communicate have changed dramatically over the past decades, but technology and tools in healthcare have not kept pace. Patients want more access and digital convenience, as well as the ability to text their care teams. Care teams are inundated with more communication and rising expectations, but are still using tools and technology stuck in prior decades. Spruce Health created a solution for the tech-forward DPC practice by creating a communication product designed to serve both the patient and the doctor through intuitive HIPAA-compliant workflows, tagging, scheduled messages, and triage templates ready for use, whether you're on your phone or in the exam room. New users get 20% off for the first 12 months of a paid plan with code MARYAL20. That's MARYAL20. So check out Spruce Health today at sprucehealth.com or check out the link in the show notes.
Going back to near when you were mentioning Yelp, Facebook, Google Ads, how do you encourage patients to leave reviews for your care?
You know, you just want to ask your patients to leave a review. You know, they're happy to do it when you ask them to do it. It's just not something that's on the top of everybody's minds to leave reviews, you know, at places that they shop and do business at. So just asking your patients to leave a review, you know, especially when they're talking about things that you've done for them that they, you know, that they really appreciate, you know, those are good times to ask for reviews. I usually ask if a patient leaves the practice. That's usually when I'm asking for the review because I'm obviously not in the room with them, you know, on a regular basis. But if they leave the practice, usually, you know, for moving out of town or out of state, I'll ask them if they could leave a review, just a quick and honest review about their experience working with our practice.
If someone says something really complimentary to me, whether that's through, you know, a Spruce message or like in the office directly to me, I tell them I appreciate your kind words. Do you mind putting a review on Facebook, Yelp, or Google reviews to just help us grow the practice?
As a physician, it's definitely not something that we were ever trained in, right? It's very much a corporate thing. I didn't realize, you know, I have over 140 reviews after 5 years of working in my job, and I've never asked someone to leave a review ever. Mm-hmm. But the corporations are very much more about the numbers. And so for building your practice up, taking a page from that notebook of using those reviews for your benefit is really powerful. When you guys opened, did you know that you wanted to scale and have additional physicians join on?
I think I knew that kind of in the back of my mind. I always knew that we were going to grow and scale and add more physicians just after realizing how amazing the model is and how much patients really enjoy this type of care and being shielded from the broken healthcare system. I knew that, the patients weren't going to stop coming. So I kind of had it in the back of my mind. I just didn't know exactly how we were going to do it. And kind of, you know, since that time, I've kind of, you know, developed a strategy of how to teach employers kind of how to break free from the broken health insurance system. And DPC is pretty much the foundation of that strategy. And so that's kind of what I'm focusing now, that's kind of helping us, you know, grow and scale with multiple physicians.
Nir, can you expand on that? In terms of how you work with employer groups and how you discuss the benefits of DPC?
So, you know, DPC, I think, is one component of a health plan. It's a very important component of the health plan. And so we try to help employers understand, you know, there are components that are built into health plans, whether they're with the major carriers that we all know or with, you know, more independent third party administrators that are running these health plans. And so we just try to help the employer understand there's a couple different structures of insurance and how DPC could fit, you know, in one or the other. And how are those plans structured to actually do the right thing for those employer groups and benefit their employees by increasing their health and also, you know, controlling costs and saving money on the healthcare spend.
And when you approach an employer who might be in a fully insured plan and they are looking to potentially do like a self-funded plan, including DPC, do you approach employers or do you find employers are approaching you or both?
I would say a little bit of both. It's probably more, you know, we're trying to relate, you know, understand where we might have connections and relationships to talk to business owners. But there are businesses that are also reaching out to us to see how we could help them.
And when you do approach an employer who has never been on any, or who has never offered anything but a fully insured plan, what's that dialogue like?
We just kind of help them understand some of the broken parts of fully insured health plans. You know, BUCA is an acronym that stands for Blue Cross United, Cigna, Aetna, Humana, and those are the main carriers that are typically offering fully insured plans to employers all across the country. And I feel that fully insured plans with those BUCAs are broken. And there's a couple reasons. Number one, when they rate your premium, they don't rate it on anything logical. They're rating it on a spreadsheet of your employees' demographics, you know, age and zip code, basically. And so they're assuming that everybody's ill in your group. And so those rates typically come back pretty high. And then once you get those rates and you take a plan and you start paying for it, you're essentially paying that money into a black hole. And I say that because you don't understand you don't have any transparency on what the insurance company is doing with your money. They just collect it, but they don't tell you anything about what they're doing with it. And if you have a healthy year and your employees have a healthy year, they don't give any of it back to you. And then, you know, the other reason I think that that side of the health insurance system is broken is just because of the way that the health insurance agencies and brokerages are paid. On fully insured plans, they're paid a commission based on the premium amount. So for them to do the right thing, there's really no motivation, right? They're making more money as their clients' premiums grow. And the BUCAs want to maximize their profits as much as they possibly can. And so they're trying to increase renewal rates as much, you know, as high as they can. And they have to have supporting claims data to do that. And that's why I feel that they've brainwashed us in this country to think that we need to file a health insurance claim for every single thing we do for our health.
And have you noticed that the increasing rates are what have driven employers to reach out to you guys?
Definitely. You know, fully insured plans are going up year over year over year, about 10 to 30%. So, you know, when you're a smaller company, that may not be meaningful to your bottom line, you know, it may get hidden. But as you grow larger and you have more employees that you're covering, and that line item, that health insurance line item, becomes one of the most expensive line items on your P&L, you start to realize that you can't take 10 to 30% increases every single year. Because one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to have to shut your business down, or you're going to have to create new revenue streams just to pay for the health plan.
And when you start talking about self-funded plans, what does an ideal self-funded plan look like to you? And what are some do's and don'ts when you're considering a self-funded plan that you recommend to employers?
Self-funded and level funded kind of go hand in hand. So self-funded is typically for larger employers with lots of employees, and level funded is typically for smaller employers. You know, we can set up employers on level funded plans with 5 employees enrolled. So the main difference between self and level funded and fully insured plans is that the self-funded plans are underwritten. So the carriers are rating the premiums based on something logical, which is the health conditions of the group. And we get that one of two ways. Either the employees fill out a couple, one or two page health questionnaire, or we use claims data from their current plan to underwrite the self-funded plan. And that allows us to get a much better rate typically, because the presumption is if you're working, you're typically healthy.
In addition to the roles that you already hold at Direct Med, you've recently become licensed in health insurance. Can you tell us a little bit more about that journey?
Sure. So just to kind of add to what I was saying about, you know, this strategy that we teach employer groups, I decided at the beginning of 2020 that it made sense for me to become licensed in health insurance and create an agency that can help our practice and our employer groups, as well as other DPCs and their employer groups, implement this strategy successfully. So we created Virtuous Benefits also at the beginning of 2020, and we have been helping educate employers pretty much across the country on this strategy of moving to a level or self-funded plan, and including direct primary care as the foundation of that plan that's going to be able to not only protect all of the money in the claims fund and also the renewal rates, but also physically increase the health of your employees to make, you know, a healthy, happy, productive workforce. I think that employers who are looking for good health care for their business and their employees should really be asking some of the more challenging questions, you know, with regards to how is the health plan actually going to work for them and how is it going to benefit them, not only financially, but also by making their workforce healthier. And I think that's where a lot of employers across the country are missing the boat, you know, because they're just going to brokers to get them a quote, you know, just to basically check a box and say, we need to offer health insurance or we want to offer health insurance because we have too much turnover. And so we just need to get a plan. I think they need to understand, you know, what does the health plan do to help them control their costs? Because I think we all, you know, understand that the health care system in this country is very broken. The actual cost of health care is much lower than what the quote unquote insurance prices are that everybody's paying when they go and use their BUCA insurance cards to shop for healthcare. So we teach employers about how to set up a plan that allows them to pay for the actual costs of healthcare. And so, you know, an example would be a knee surgery at the big major hospital downtown. They might charge $40,000 for that knee surgery and they might not have the best ratings and outcomes versus a independent surgery center that might charge $20,000 for that surgery and have, you know, much better outcomes and be, you know, defined as sort of a high performance facility. And so our plans incentivize those employees to make the right decision and go to the independent facility that's high performance, that's going to be half the price and will remove their deductible for making that choice. And so I think employers just want to, you know, ask those questions to try to understand how is the health plan going to work for them? How is it going to save them money? And how is it going to increase the health of their employees?
DPC doctors are employers too. And I know that there are DPC doctors who at this point are not offering benefits to their staff, but who are considering it. So that answer is very universal for people who are even DPC employers. How is your strategy for building a health plan different than plugging an employer into a BUCA health plan?
It's different because, you know, the BUCAs have created their health plans and, you know, inserted all of their own vendors solely for maximizing their own profit. That's all they really care about. So an example would be Aetna, who owns CVS. Aetna uses CVS as the PBM for all their health plans. And if you want to use somebody else, they won't let you because that's how they maximize their profits. In our plans, you know, we're removing that BUCA network completely. Direct primary care over the last 15, 20 years has proven across this whole country that we don't need a network for our care. And so we are helping an employer build a quote unquote employer built health plan rather than an insurer built health plan. And really what that means is we're kind of helping them insert all of the vendors that are independent and transparent as far as fees. And also, you know, what their contributions are to the program, and everybody's on the same page with regards to, you know, we're going to make sure that the patients get the best care possible and that they're not going to overpay for something that they need for their health. So it all starts with the TPA, which is a third party administrator, and they are who manage and administer the claims. And then there's a PBM, which would be independent, and, you know, they would have transparent fees. So they're going to make their money on a transaction and then get the medications at the best cost they can get rather than marking the medications up over and over and over again, as we see happening in the BUCA side. And an independent direct primary care practice is also another vendor that we would insert into the plan. So, and that's one of the most important ones because the direct primary care practice is going to take care of about 90% of all the employees' healthcare needs. And so what they're doing is they're essentially steering all of those unnecessary claims away from the health plan. And that's doing a couple things. That's protecting all of the claims fund money. So when you have a self or level funded plan, 20 to 50% of the premium for each individual is getting set aside into a claims fund every month. And that claims fund is building and growing. And the more employees you have, the larger it's going to be. And the TPA will use those funds to pay for claims. So when the DPC is steering all those unnecessary claims away from the plan, we're essentially protecting all of that claims fund money. And if there's a surplus in that account at the end of the year, the employer gets it refunded back to them at 100%. So it's a very powerful component within the health plan. Then the DPC is also protecting the renewal rate. Insurance companies can only raise renewal rates annually based on supporting claims data. So if the DPC is taking really good care of all the patients and they're steering all those unnecessary claims away, the claims that are filed throughout the year for that group typically are dramatically reduced. And so carriers at renewal don't have any leverage to increase the rates anywhere close to the 10 to 30% that's happening, you know, across the country today. So we try to get employers to the point where, you know, they can, their renewals either stay flat or they start to decrease.
As you're describing this, you're incorporating DPC, but you're not talking about lowering the cost of DPC.
Right. So having a DPC practice myself, I understand the tremendous value that DPC physicians provide to their patients. And that goes the same for employer patients, right? So we are teaching employers how valuable the DPC is, because like I mentioned, the DPC is protecting all of the money. And the DPC is also physically increasing the health of all the patients. So we make sure that the DPC's value remains high because they are doing, you know, they're such a critical component of the plan. And also we want to make sure that our DPC practices are successful and that we stay open and we continue to thrive. And if we devalue ourselves to, a certain level that's unsustainable, then we won't be able to continue practicing and continue doing all the good work that we're doing. So it's very important to keep the DPC value high in every aspect, you know, financially and also care.
As you guys have continued to incorporate the value and make the value very apparent to employers with these insurance plans and to patients who are just signing up, how did you guys develop your pricing strategy?
Well, there wasn't a lot to it other than when we were first talking to Dr. Chris Larson and we asked him how he did it. He was just like, you need to calculate out how much you want to make and how many patients you want to see and do the math on it. And there's a lot of DPCs that do age-based pricing, and they can have several different brackets, but we just wanted to keep it super simple. And I don't know, I just feel like $87 had a ring to it for an adult. And then we cut that in half for kids' rate. And so that's why it's $43.50. It wasn't rocket science behind it.
Have you guys increased prices over the years?
We have not. We've had the same pricing for the last 6 years.
Looking back on when you guys made the jump into DPC and you were developing this pricing strategy, given the fact that you guys are parents with two kids, what advice do you have for parents or others who are financially scared about jumping into DPC?
It is a scary jump. I mean, I came from a salary job into making, like, there's no guarantee to my salary. So thankfully, Near had a salary job in corporate America that was a buffer. But in addition to keeping our overhead costs low at the practice, I was moonlighting at different places until I could build up my panel and have a decent income from that. And so from the very beginning, I had like two locums jobs and then was still building up my dark primary care panel. And so I had zero patients from the very beginning. And I had no referrals from other places like that I used to work at. And so it was really kind of grassroots marketing to get started. So it was pretty slow in the beginning. So I worked at a community care center, like a couple days a week, like full days. And then I also worked like Monday, Wednesday, and some Fridays at a geriatric urgent care clinic from like 5 to 9 on those nights. And then I still, I was credentialed with a telemedicine company called Teladoc, and I was still doing calls like on the weekends and then just whenever. So, I mean, I was definitely hustling. Like you kind of have to hustle, and it's a lot of work. I mean, it wasn't an easy transition, but with great risk comes great reward. So I was willing to do that because I just couldn't see myself practicing medicine for the next 20 years. In what I was doing before. So you kind of have to hustle, you do locums work, and then as your patient panel grows, then you can start to shed some of the locums work. So after my first child was born, which was like literally like 8 months into the practice, I dropped my Tuesday, Thursday locums job and then just kept my Monday, Wednesday, Friday evening job and then telemedicine. And then I think it was when I was pregnant with the second kid that I'm just like, I can't keep doing all this. And then, so I dropped the urgent care job and then was just doing my practice and then occasionally doing teledoc. And then I just kind of got tired of doing teledoc on the side. And now I have like a full patient panel. So I definitely grew the panel much slower than some of the other DPCs that we're aware of, just because I also had two kids during that process. So it was intentional slow growth because I was a solo practitioner and like I took a week off after each child was born. And a lot of my, you know, patients from the beginning would welcome the newborn baby in the office, and a lot of them really enjoyed it. Obviously all pre-COVID, and the first kid was really easy to take because he was just a really easy baby, but I would nurse him in between patients and he'd hang out and sleep. And then if the baby woke up, I'd go grab him. And it's like, it was truly like an old school family medicine. I'd have the baby on my lap and then be listening to the person or sending their prescription or writing up their orders. And then if I needed two hands, I'd sometimes it's happened where I'd ask my patient, here, can you hold the baby? and then I like printed something out or whatever, you know, and I mean, that didn't happen that often, but it was really amazing just being part of the community. And especially my, you know, early on, my patients understood that I was a young mother and getting my practice started, and they were really, they really loved it. It just transported me back to like the 1950s, you know, if I were to time travel, like it felt like I was a family doctor back then.
That's just incredible. And, you know, as a mother with an infant, I think about how crazy it can be when you can do 5 million things at the exact same time, including holding a baby and listening to patients. But when you're in a fee-for-service crunch, you know, that can't ever happen when, as a patient is crying in front of you, thinking I have to leave to see the next patient because I'm an hour behind. And to have taken yourself out of that situation, even though you had to hustle to get there, I cannot imagine the rewards that you experience now, in addition to having a patient hold your baby while you were, while you were working. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It actually even happened just yesterday. So we had some childcare shortage yesterday. Thursday afternoon. And I had some morning patients that I was up at the office by myself for. And then I came home and was hanging out with the kids. And I just had to run up to the office for like literally a blood pressure check. And so I'm like, well, I'll take the kids with me. They'll be fine. And they're older now. They can watch their little show on my phone. And so I went up to the office just to see one person. And it was literally a quick check. And so I just had the kids in the other room and they had my phone and they know to use their inside voices and to come get me if there's anything that they need. And so I'm sitting in the next room talking to my patient about his new blood pressure medicine and yada, yada. And then next thing I know, the exam room door opens and my five-year-old comes to find me. And I'm like, oh, excuse me. And I had to go see what the problem was with the kids because they were fighting. But my patient just laughed. He thought it was awesome because I take care of his whole family. And like, he's got stepkids and his own daughters and his wife. And I think it invites them into your own family. And my patients are part and extension of our family. And I think that a lot of the patients see it that way. I run into my patients at the local grocery store and they'll update me with things about seeing their cardiologist and whatnot. So it's just, DPC has given us this ability to be a human, but also to still care for your patients as members, as part of the community. So it's a real blessing. It's a real privilege. And I really enjoy it. I will never go back to the old insurance-based world.
There was a baby, because I still take care of newborns. There was a baby who mom hasn't had a kid in 12 years. And she called me, or she called the clinic. And my husband's a family medicine doc in our clinic too. And so he texts me, he's like, hey, this kid, can you tell me more about him? And the kid's 2 weeks old. So I was like, I'm home, I'm not working, but I'll just call the mom. And then my 3-year-old was having a massive tantrum I was like, I'm so sorry. I felt so uncomfortable. And she was like, it's totally fine. I'm calling you about my 2 week old infant who's bawling on the phone and having a rash. It's so crazy how unacceptable you feel it is to have, you know, these distractions. And it's not at all unacceptable. So that's wonderful that, you know, your patients have become an extension of your family and how you make it work.
Yeah. And I think it just, you know, I don't know what your experience was like in residency or even, you know, outside of residency, but medicine has gotten very corporate and very cold and very sterile. And we sometimes will forget the human that we're treating, as well as the provider too, is a human and has, you know, emotions and a family and their own health concerns. And I feel like DPC helps us, for the most part, see that more, like, as, you know, you're just treating another human and they see you as a human too, because they see that you have a family and you have, you know, health concerns yourself. Like they just see you more so as a person, I feel like. And I feel like just having that compassion for the other person allows us to have a deeper connection and more meaningful. And I know that my patients take my advice a lot. It's a heavier weighted now than when I worked like in urgent care and I was just a doc in the box, you know, and because they know me, they know my family, they know that I'm going to be speaking from the heart and I have their best interest. And they just feel that more when they actually know me as a person.
If others are listening and wish to connect with you guys, what's the best way to reach out to you?
Yeah. So the best way to reach out to us is just, you know, to contact us on really any of the contact methods we have on our website. So, you know, our email info@directmed.care. Our website is www.directmed.care. Our phone number is 512-842-7633. And you can also live chat with us on our website. And, you know, I encourage anybody who, you know, is exploring this model or, you know, is starting up or has been practicing for a couple of years and has questions, I mean, feel free to reach out. Both of us are happy to help answer any questions and point and guide our colleagues in the right direction whenever we can.
Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Awesome. We had a great time. Thanks.
Next week, look forward to hearing from Dr. Adam Schulte of The Drop-In Doc. If you like what you heard today, please leave a review and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tell your friends, too. For more information on this episode and much more, please visit mydpcstory.com. Also, for up-to-date information and news on DPC, check out dpcnews.com. Until next week, this is Marielle Conception.